This is Amarins. Hi again. My name is Arthur, and I'm a gay American now living in New Zealand. Welcome to episode 43. It's Tuesday, October 9, as I record this here in New Zealand, but it's still Monday in North America. So happy Columbus Day to listeners in the U.S., and happy Thanksgiving to Canadians. Now, first up today, I have some bits of good news to report. My monthly project that takes place the first week of every month was completed on Thursday, which is much better than the month before. And that left me free to spend Friday with Nigel, which is always a good thing, because he had the day off, you may recall. In totally unrelated matters, I've been complaining lately about not having Mac word processing software with a functioning spelling checker. Well, I've solved that through dogged perseverance. Now, the main program that I use is NeoOffice, which is the version of the free OpenOffice application written specifically for the Mac. The OpenOffice for Mac is actually a Linux version that's ported to Mac, and supposedly it doesn't work as well or something. I don't really understand. But anyway, this is what I've got. But from the moment I installed it, the spelling checker didn't work. I mean, everything said it was New Zealand and all that, but no spelling checker. And because of that, I was within a hair's breadth of buying Microsoft's Office Mac. And the only reason I didn't, actually, was because I knew the new version was coming out, and I thought, no, I'll just wait and see. Well, buried in a NeoOffice forum, I found out that you need to install a dictionary separately. It's probably if you're using any language other than U.S. English, but maybe it's U.S. English too, for all I know. At any rate, I did that, and the spelling checker now works perfectly, and you have no idea how glad I am about that. But the biggest news is that yesterday I took our puppy Jake in for his desexing operation, and he came through it just fine. I took him in the morning, and he first had a bit of a checkup, and I was given options for blood tests and intravenous solution during the surgery. And I thought it was really weird that these were options. I mean, I would have thought you'd want whatever was necessary or needed. But I suppose some people must not want to pay for extras or something. I don't really know. I actually wrote a blog post of all the details. If you want to read it, you can, by all means, go to my blog, amarins.blogspot.com. But one thing was that as we're finishing up, the vet took down my contact phone numbers. And I said, now, just make sure you can note somewhere that it's very important that someone call me as soon as Jake is in recovery. And I explained that we just lost our dog a few months before and that we lost our cat a month ago from cancer. And I felt myself tearing up as I was telling her that. And I thought, oh, geez, I don't want to start crying. And I didn't, fortunately. But I was surprised me, I have to say. But as it happens, as soon as he was waking up, she rang me immediately and told me, which is all very good. And his behavior is, since has been exactly as they said it would be, you know, just a little bit subdued maybe. But other than that, he's basically fine. He's eating normally and all the rest. So, yeah, he goes back in 2 weeks to have his stitches removed. And up until then, he's supposed to only have light exercise. So that's fine too. When he was in there, he was also microchipped. And there too, I picked the more deluxe version of the microchip because the basic version that meets the legal requirement is registered in New Zealand, but the more deluxe version is throughout the Asia-Pacific region, or actually probably just Australasia and Pacific. And the reason that's important is because in the unlikely event we were ever to move to Australia with Jake, the microchip registration would still be valid. We wouldn't have to do it all over again or whatever. So it was just a little precaution, because you never know what the future holds. I mean, the chances of us living in Australia are probably slim to none, but hey, 15 years ago, if anyone had asked if I'd be living in New Zealand, I would have said, no way. So I've learned to just cover my options as much as possible. The microchipping itself was originally brought in as a result of some dog attacks, some fairly horrific dog attacks on children in particular. And the central idea behind it is that if a vicious dog is found wandering the streets, they'll know who the owner is. But that supposes, of course, that the owner of the dog has had it microchipped and registered. And very often these dogs are owned by people who have no interest in obeying the law of any kind, let alone for dog registration and microchipping. But it does also mean that if they find a dog who's not microchipped, who's of a certain age, that they can be seized and theoretically anyway put down if they can't be rehomed. But for responsible dog owners, such as ourselves, microchipping does have an advantage, and that's that if he's ever found wandering around, or, God forbid, was stolen, they would be able to find out who he was and who he belonged to, so we could get him back. So that's a good thing for us, anyway. And he doesn't seem to notice. It's about the size of a grain of rice, and it's implanted in the back of their neck somewhere. I haven't felt it myself, but I haven't wanted to poke around because he might still be a bit tender. He actually also had extra baby teeth. I didn't mention this in the blog post. And his baby teeth for his canines, upper canines, hadn't come out, but his adult ones had come in. So he actually had two sets of fangs on both sides. It looks really scary, actually. But while he was under anesthetic, they took the baby teeth out because they should be gone by now because he is now 6 months old. So those are all the bits of good news that I wanted to report. Now, this week, our local elections are drawing to a close. The deadline is this coming Saturday. Nigel and I have already mailed in our ballots, but there's a huge concern that many people won't bother to do that. In the last local elections 3 years ago, just under half, something like 48.6% or something like that, of Auckland City residents mailed in their ballots, but only around a third of North Shore City residents did. Actually, I think it was less than a third, it was 30-odd percent, 30-point-something. But this contrasts with turnouts of 70-80% in normal elections. Now, no one knows for sure why the turnout in these local elections is so low, apart from the fact that the local elections are done by postal ballot and the ordinary national elections are done the conventional way at polling places. Nevertheless, it's generally thought that the fact that most people have no idea who the people running are, who the candidates are, is part of the reason why the return is so low. Now, I know that I had no idea who many of the candidates were or what their platform was. So I ended up just voting for the ones I did know about, and I didn't vote at all for Auckland Regional Council because I know nothing about any of the candidates. Here's the thing. It's sometimes argued that it's my duty as a voter, in this case, to find out the information about the candidates. And the election authority does include a little booklet with the ballot, and that booklet contains biographies or summaries provided by the candidates. But very often, these say nothing at all, or nothing coherent sometimes, it has to be said. The local media provides poor coverage, you'd have to say, of most local election races, apart maybe from mayoral contests in the larger cities. So that means that voters have to find a way to contact the candidates and ask them questions, which is, of course, time-consuming, and potentially there's a cost, like the phone calls, for instance, especially because in some cases all you can find is a cell phone number, which is more expensive than a landline call. Now, few candidates did have websites, and some sent out brochures, but most of them did neither. There weren't many Meet the Candidates meetings, as far as I know, although the news media didn't cover them, so if there were any, I just don't know about them. And since most of the races are nonpartisan, voters can't even use a party platform to, you know, get even a rough idea of how the person is going to vote if they're elected. So, you know, really, what's an ordinary voter supposed to do? I think there's got to be a better way of handling local elections, but at the moment I'm not sure what it is. But I don't think it's fair to blame the voters for not knowing about the candidates when the candidates are doing, in most cases, little to no outreach. And when the media isn't helping to educate voters, that leaves the voters with really the only alternative left for voters is to try to find the phone number of the candidate and ring them up and ask them questions. And realistically, how many people are going to do that? And in my opinion, why should they have to? There should be, and I don't know what the answer is because I don't want to tell business you must cover the local elections because that doesn't work either. And the booklet that the election authorities sent out is a good start, but clearly it's not all that great. So I'm not quite sure what the solution is here, but there's got to be a better way. I mean, people don't have this trouble with the national elections. Candidates do go door-to-door in some cases in the national elections, or at least their volunteers do. They do send out literature. They very often have websites, or at the very least the party has websites, and parties put out election manifestos, so you know, in general terms at least, what the candidate is likely to do if elected. So it's a little bit easier to make a decision. In fact, it's a lot easier to make a decision on the national level than it is on the local level. But, you know, in my case, not voting for all of the city council candidates I was entitled to vote for, there's five in our ward, wasn't just the fact that I didn't know who these other people are, because some of them I had a vague idea, but it was also because there were a couple of candidates that I wanted to make sure won. And so strategically, it was smarter to withhold votes, to only vote for two or three of the candidates running instead of five, because proportionally then they get more of the votes. It's sort of complicated, but the same strategy we used to use in Illinois, because in the Illinois House of Representatives years ago, it used to be that each representative district elected three representatives, and you could vote for one, two, or three. And if you voted for three, they each got one vote. If you voted for two, they each got one and a half. And if you voted for one, they got three. This was called bullet voting. And it could be used strategically to get a candidate that you preferred elected to the legislature. Now, that was abolished by this thing they called the House Cutback Amendment, and it's now just like most other places with single-member districts. But that's when I first learned the idea of strategic voting, and I still do that to some extent, although on the national level it's different again, but I'll talk about that in the context of the national elections because it does get a bit confusing. But speaking of voting, see, I always come up with these transitions. For about a week or so, I had a poll on my blog about books asking which of the various New Zealand writers people had read. And the results, I'll read you the list and what the results were. It was Janet Frame, 2, Elizabeth Knox, 2, Witi'ihi Maira, 4, Owen Marshall, 2, Frank Sargeson, 3, Peter Wells, 3, and none of these, 12. Now, people could vote for more than one, and there were 17 altogether. So 12 of those people were had none of them, and then the rest, presumably, voted for, were divided up. Oh, that doesn't quite add up right. I'm not quite sure how that calculates, but take my word for it. So what I thought I would do is tell you a little bit about who these writers are, mini bios, and anything that I might personally know about their work, in case you feel like checking them out yourself. Now, the first person on the list was Janet Frame, who was born in Dunedin in the South Island in 1924. Now, in 1947, she was doing student teaching in preparation to being a teacher, and she walked out of the classroom and because she decided she wanted to devote her life to literature and not to teaching, which is fair enough. But her school, her university, pressured her parents into having her committed to an insane asylum. Obviously, if she wanted literature instead of teaching, she must have been insane. But when she was there, she was misdiagnosed with schizophrenia. And as a result of that, she endured over 200 shock treatments. In 1951, she was actually scheduled for lobotomy, but was spared only because her first collection of stories, The Lagoon and Other Stories, won a prestigious prize. She actually, it was actually published while she was in the asylum. She was finally released in 1955, and then she went and stayed for about a year in an outbuilding by the home of Frank Sargeson, who I'll talk about shortly. And he sort of mentored her, and that's where she wrote her first novel, Owls Do Cry. Her three-volume autobiography was made into a film called An Angel at My Table, which is made by Jane Campion, who, of course, also directed The Piano. And she died of leukemia in 2004. But she's considered one of New Zealand's greatest short story writers. Next on the list was Elizabeth Knox, who was born in 1959 in Wellington. She wrote a critically acclaimed novel, The Vintner's Luck, which is being made into a film by Nicky Caro, who also made The Whale Rider and the American film North Country. The novel was a huge hit in New Zealand. And, of course, it's all relative. The thing is that a bestseller in New Zealand could sell as few as 1,500 copies, or a good seller, anyway. Hers was something like 20,000 when I lost track of it. It's probably far more than that now. But a typical New Zealand author makes 50 cents a novel, maybe a dollar a book. So let's just suppose that an author manages to sell 50,000 copies of their book. They get 50,000 New Zealand dollars, which sounds great, except that that's a reasonable income for a year. Unfortunately, however, most books take multiple years to write. Most novelists will take 2 or 3 years to write a novel, and if they only get enough income for 1 year out of it, it's not that great a deal. So most novelists in particular, or short story writers too, do other things for a living. So it's a bit relative. I mean, in America, you can be a full-time writer and have only relatively small success and still make enough money because of the size of America you can still make enough money to be able to do that exclusively or nearly exclusively. In New Zealand, unless you have overseas success, it's very difficult to make a living as a full-time writer. As it happens, however, The Vintner's Luck was published, or actually around the world, it's been translated into several languages, and it is available in America. And it's a really interesting book. I haven't finished it, I have to say. However, without giving too much away, the story is about a French winemaker who is visited by a male angel whose wings smell of snow. I just thought that was a really evocative way of describing the wings. But the vintner falls in love with the angel and decides that he wants to have sex with him. And that is all I can tell you about, because that's about as far as I got in the book. So I don't know what happens. But it is a kind of haunting novel in some ways. And it's worth checking out if you have the opportunity. It's probably one of a few New Zealand novels that you can probably get your hands on at any decent-sized bookstore or library in America, particularly with a movie coming next year sometime. Next on the list was Riti Ihimaira, who was born in Gisborne in 1944. He is the world's first Maori novelist, and he's actually also the first Maori to publish a book of short stories, and he's gay. His first gay novel was Nights in the Garden of Spain, and more recently he also wrote The Uncle's Story, which I think I've mentioned before. Now, his work often explores Maori themes like Maori adapting to the modern world, Maori spirituality, and so on. I find his writing, personally, I find his writing to be lyrical, which isn't surprising, I suppose, since he's also an opera lyricist, or whatever you call it for opera people. I'm not into opera, so I don't know. But probably his best-known book would be The Whale Rider, since it was made into a film. But that's not necessarily atypical of the sorts of things he talks about modernity and ancient spiritual beliefs sort of combining and mixing and collaging or whatever. I highly recommend his writing. So if you have a chance to find anything by him, by all means pick it up. And in particular, his gay novel, The Uncle's Story, which I actually have not read. I've read excerpts from it, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And I've never read Nights in the Garden of Spain, his first gay novel. But I've read bits and pieces of other things. I've read some short stories. I read a song cycle that he had written that's in a book, which I'll talk about later. And I highly recommend checking him out. Next on the list was Owen Marshall, who was born in 1941 in Tikuiti. He's a novelist and short story writer, and he's often included in the list of great short story writers, with Janet Frame and Frank Sargeson, who I'll talk about in a minute. However, I haven't read anything by him, so I could not tell you a thing about him or what his writing is like. In truth, the only reason why he was on the list at all is because I actually have one of his books here in the house. I bought it on special somewhere. And I haven't read it yet, so I can't tell you any more than that. And next was Frank Sargeson. Now, that's the pen name of a man who was born in 1903 in Hamilton, and he's often considered New Zealand's greatest short story writer, or certainly the greatest male short story writer. He was homosexual, but not gay in the modern sense. In 1929, he was in a hotel room with a man when the police burst in and caught them masturbating each other. Apparently, the police had deliberately rented the room next door because they found the man of questionable character. And so that's why they were there, and that's why they burst in. The other man was sent to prison, but Sargeson was found innocent, with the court deciding that he was an innocent young man seduced by the older man. Nevertheless, he lost his job instantly and could never practice law again. And the late historian Michael King theorized that that's why Sargeson picked that pen name, to sort of hide from his past. His stories have an implied homoeroticism and an exploration of same-sex love, but never from an explicitly gay perspective, or even in some ways you could say even a remotely gay perspective, but certainly a gay reader reading between the lines can see the subtext. But there's an irony in him. He's one of the gay ancestors, you could say, gay literary ancestors. But he was clearly repressed and victimized because of his sexuality. And his stories were about stoic males and about their way in the world and the way they related to each other. And he ended up in some ways sort of symbolizing the ideal, or his characters, I should say, ended up symbolizing in some ways the ideal New Zealand male, which is really ironic when you stop to think about it. He died in 1982. And the last writer on the list was Peter Wells, who is a gay writer and filmmaker. I read part of his novel, Boy Overboard, and I have to admit, I didn't really care for it. I found it a bit odd and hard to follow. He is also the editor of an anthology called Best Mates, Gay Writing Aotearoa, New Zealand. And I have to be honest, I pulled it off the shelf mainly so that I could read some of the writers that were in the poll, like Frank Sargeson, so that I could participate. But the introduction that he wrote is just fascinating. It's basically, he covers the history of literature, gay literature. But some of the insights that he provides are really good, and some of the history I hadn't read before. The book came out in 1997, and some of them have been superseded. Some of this has been superseded since the book came out. But one of the things he talks about was a novel called A Way of Love, which was New Zealand's first gay novel, which was published in 1959 by James Courage. And the book was actually first published in London and then in New York. And when it was brought into New Zealand, 2 years later, it ended up being banned. They said it had undue emphasis upon matters of sex, and it was a book of no redeeming literary merit, even though the author had a bestseller only a few years before called The Young Have Secrets from 1954. But it's fascinating to me, really, how far New Zealand has come in that time between the publication of the first gay novel. It was only in 1959. It ends up being banned 2 years later. Until now, there's quite a thriving, not industry exactly, but there's quite a lot of gay writing out there, both in novel and short story form. But what also fascinated me about that book is, about the book Best Mates, is that the writer of that novel, James Courage, was clearly gay. I mean, there's no way around that. And there are also others who were as well, a man named Charles Brash and E.H. McCormick, for example. But here's something that's interesting. It's just just one paragraph from this novel, which I'll read you. Because what happened is that when they were compiling the anthology, they wanted to include the works of those three men in the book. And the literary executors refused for all three of them. And in some cases saying it was impossible to read the writer's work and assume that he was gay from reading the work, that it was not, clearly not gay. No. Well, here's what Peter Wells says about that. James Courage, Charles Brash, and E.H. McCormick are all now dead. Their executors have all separately refused permission to reprint their works in this anthology. The problem has been the homosexual identification of the anthology, though in McCormick's case the publication was prevented by contractual obligations elsewhere. What is one to do in this situation? Personally, I felt a weight of despair that men like Courage and Brash, who had to suffer in silence during their own lifetime, were now being nurtured into a deeper silence and covert oblivion. The executors seemed to conceive of their role as continuing a last line of defense, dirtying the waters by demi-denials, hoping against hope that relief shall come in protracted waitings, because their papers aren't going to be released until sometime this century. He goes on, "There appears to be little sense of the necessity, on the part of the executors, of connecting past writers to living audiences. Even worse, there is a positive sense of denigration involved, of a homosexual readership seen as a bad, even worthless thing. It saddened me that these men, Courage, Brash, and McCormick, who stood for such boldness in the past, could be represented in the present by such mealy-mouthed prevarication, such morbid timidity." I couldn't agree with him more. And what they ended up doing was putting in three blank pages in the book, one with a name, a page for each person. And I remember when the book came out that the executor, I think it was for Charles Brash, but I could be mistaken, was absolutely livid that they would do that. How dare they imply that he was homosexual when he was not, despite all of the evidence to the contrary. But there you go. I mean, dead men tell no tales, I suppose. So now I'm going to move on to the comments. First over at Blogspot, ammermans.blogspot.com. And first up was Eric, who said, "Meh, again, you're so mean," with a little winky sign. "Actually, I have nothing to say about Enda at this point, because I'm really pulling a see it both ways here. On the one hand, isn't any protection good? On the other, how can we spend so much time asking for our whole LGBT community to work together only to drop one segment like a hot potato just for political expediency? Also, I didn't even really know about the Podomatic rankings. I'm just bleeding the old iTunes horn, and honestly, I don't even know why. I guess old acting habits die hard, and this bitch needs an audience. And I said, I actually see the point of going with the original Enda, too. Original means without trans people, because trans people were added, and now they want to take them out again. But my point is, it can't become law, no matter what, so why compromise or even entertain the notion? Mostly, though, I'm not comfortable with the idea that the way to win justice is to deny it to others, and yes, I know it's been done before. As I predicted, you pulled ahead of me on the Podomatic rankings. Good thing I don't pay any attention to rankings. Clearly I do pay attention to rankings, or I wouldn't mention it, would I? But, just one other point. When I talk about, when I said I'm not comfortable with the idea that the way to win justice is to deny it to others, and yes, I know it's been done before, what I was thinking of specifically was that during the Black Civil Rights Movement, gay people were all over the place in that movement, gay men in particular, but also lesbians. And I'm thinking famously in my head, in trying to help win the civil rights of African Americans. Now, the African American leaders of the time didn't say, "Now, hang on a minute, we are not going to accept our civil rights until these homosexuals get civil rights as well." They fought for their own rights. And this point has been brought up in a number of different places that I've seen. And that's valid up to a point. However, the difference is that they weren't trying to do a broad-based civil rights movement. They were trying to focus specifically on the rights of the rights denied to African Americans. And gay and lesbian people joined the struggle knowing that and trying to work on that particular cause. The gay and lesbian movement was a little bit different in that it was more of, it was a movement based on outlawing discrimination based on sexuality, but also gender identification, because part of the problems that gay men and lesbians have is when the heterosexual majority feels that they are behaving in non-gender appropriate ways, when men are too femme or women are too butch, for example. And it could just simply be that they don't conform in other ways, like not marrying a person of the opposite sex. So it's more complicated than just the African-American civil rights movement. And so I don't think that argument is totally valid. I mean, I understand why people make it, and I think they have a point, but I don't think that it's strong enough. It's a strong enough reason to jettison transgendered people just because African Americans didn't say, "Well, we're not having our rights unless everybody does." This is a very complicated issue, and it is one that the larger community needs to talk about. It needs to try to come to some sort of consensus about. But essentially, and this gets back to what I was talking about in the last episode, it is sort of a pragmatic approach, really, which is what I was when I was an activist. Since the measure isn't going to become law, why go through the convulsions of trying to exclude a segment of the community when it's not going to make any difference? Would I feel differently if there was a chance to pass it without transgendered people and have Bush sign it into law? I would like to say no, but I honestly don't know. Nevertheless, that's how I feel about it, and I'm always interested in what you think. Next up was Archer, who said, "I liked all the names you came up with for your podcast. However, I think you should keep it the way it is. Congratulations on passing your 6-month anniversary." And I said, "The name will stay as it has been. I just have to be better at promotion, and being more interesting probably wouldn't hurt either." Thanks for the congrats. Now I'm closing in on episode 50 in a couple of weeks or so. And I probably should spend more time trying to promote the podcast. You know, a lot of people make fun of Tom from Ramble Redhead, rambleredhead.com, for his self-promotion, but I admire him for, first of all, thinking of doing it as much as he does, in addition to doing it, because he's really good at it. I mean, his numbers are high, obviously. He gets a lot of downloads, a lot of listeners, and if you're after a large audience, that's what it's all about. Now, personally, I'm not so much after a large audience. I wouldn't mind a large audience, but that's not why I do it. But I don't know. I really admire what Tom does. I mean, he is a salesperson, so I suppose he's sort of a natural affinity for doing things that will help sell and promote the podcast. But I think he does a really great job of it, and I just wish I could be a bit more like him, I suppose. Now, I'm just going to jump over to the Podomatic site, which is amarins.podomatic.com. And Podomatic is my, what do you call it? Well, it's the host for my podcast. And they have a, what do you call it? It's not exactly a blog, but Everything you load in the show notes, the notes that go in the MP3 file are posted onto this page, which is kind of like a blog. And I'd said last week that one of the things I didn't like about it was the fact that you couldn't put a URL, and I felt that anybody who posted should be able to do that. Well, that's actually not the biggest problem with Podomatic, and that is that in order to leave a comment, you have to register first with Podomatic. And not everybody wants to do that. Not everybody will do that, as a matter of fact. Nevertheless, if you are registered with Podomatic and you want to leave a comment there, by all means do so. I think it does something to help me with my rankings on Podomatic. But anyway, if there is also the possibility, I've been trying this out. I hesitate mentioning this. This is why I'm umming a lot. There, on the right-hand side on the Podomatic page, you scroll down a ways under, where is it, Contact Me, you'll see Record a Comment. And I've been experimenting with this a little bit with a friend of mine who's on Podomatic, and I haven't been able to get it to work. But supposedly you can record a comment and email it to me as an MP3. And of course, obviously I can play it on the podcast. But that's only if you are a member of Podomatic. If you're not, and you'd like to send me an MP3, you can email it to amarins@podomatic.com. I believe that's right. No, now that I've said that, I better check. Yes, amarins@podomatic.com, PODOMATIC. And I can get an MP3 that way, too, because it's actually set up specifically for to receive MP3 files, or large files anyway. But I digress. In the comments over in Podomatic was Jason, who said, Every election cycle since 2000, there have been stories about how the far right, Christian right, is losing its hold on the Republican Party, and that simply hasn't happened. The idea that these far right nutcases will leave the party is very much wishful thinking. They will come back to the fold because they do not want to see a Democrat in the White House, no matter who he or she might be. I can't see the Republicans ever changing because the moderates, in quotes, in the Republican Party are an endangered species. The few that are left are most likely going to be voted out of office in the next election. And I said, I actually agree with you, but I enjoy seeing the infighting in the Republican Party all the same. You know, I wouldn't mind the Repubs being a right-wing Christian party nearly so much if the other rational conservatives hadn't decided to make the Democratic Party their home. And what I mean by that, basically, is that philosophically, I don't have a problem with there being a center-left party and a center-right party. I don't like them mixed up so much, and I'm not a big fan of Blue Dog Democrats or conservative Democrats. As I've said before, it's not that I'm after ideological purity, it's just that I would prefer the parties to actually stand for something and to be more distinct, because it's somebody famous, and maybe one of you will remember, but somebody famous once said there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two major parties. And although I don't think that's true, and I think it's a bit unfair to call the Democrats Republican light, it is true that in many ways there's not enough of a difference between the two parties. Certainly, the Democrats aren't nearly as weird on social issues as the Republicans are, and I'm talking about in the main, and I'm talking about the parties, not, you know, the ordinary voters or members of the party. And a Democratic president, almost no matter who was selected, would pick better Supreme Court justices than any of the Republicans. And that's going to be a very important issue. But I don't know. I think I would rather see more difference, more choice between the two parties. And that is it for this week. By all means, do leave me a comment at amarins.blogspot.com or at amarins.podomatic.com, if you're a member. And feel free to send an email to me at amarins@yahoo.com. And if you do want to send me an email to read on the podcast, just put comment in the subject line, and I'll know what to do. Otherwise, don't, and I'll know that it's not for reading on the podcast. Oh, and also, I put another poll on my blog, which is going to expire on Friday, so you'll have to vote quickly if you care at all. And it's just asking of the four remaining teams, who do you think is going to win the Rugby World Cup? Now, I personally couldn't possibly care less now that New Zealand is out of it, but you may want to cast a vote all the same, because probably some non-podcast listeners will as well. I've written a post about the game that New Zealand lost and about how that is playing out in New Zealand, which you're welcome to read if you want. It's called That Rugby Game. That is it for this week. I will talk to you next time. Have a great rest of the week, everybody. Bye.